No, our real identity. I don't have a plan, Gilbert. Not until we are there. We must see the lie of the land. But I want William Cade to pay the price for hanging young Peter Garland, and to find out where Griffith Ap Madoc has gone. If Bayard brings more men to us, we need to offer them some enticement other than allowing them to claim territory. And for that, we need the gold that was seized from us. We'll find and kill William K. Gilbert. I made that promise. It needs to be done. Well, it's better than having to stand outside a town's walls and hear those inside bleating like sheep that they do not wish to swear allegiance to Edward. At least now we do what we do best. But it might take months to track down the Welshman, and who knows how many men he will have drawn to himself by then. Bayard had better not be languishing in an Avignon brothel. Perhaps I should have asked you to go and raise troops with him, and then you could have kept an eye on him. Ah, now that would have been sensible. In fact, there is a very fine brothel in Avignon, which I would recommend. No nuns.
Thomas, do not tempt God's wrath. Nuns in brothels? That is near enough blasphemy, and—
He stopped his playful chastisement as he saw movement ahead.
Horseman,
ready yourself. William Cade's men were overconfident. They sought a quick killing, sweeping down onto the few men they saw on the road. Their intention was to kill a dozen and capture the rest. That way Cade received his bounty. Blackstone and Kilbert raised their shields and spurred their horses. The men behind them quickly formed an arrowhead formation. They had chosen this place carefully. The road ahead widened to one side, where rough mountain grass swept upwards into a forest. This expanse of rising ground forced their attackers to sweep out into the grassland. Cade's men were seasoned fighters, and their attack did not falter. They quickly swept wide, in an attempt to encircle Blackstone's horsemen, but they had not anticipated the few men they thought to quickly defeat would meet them with such ferocity. A cry of alarm went up from one of Cade's routiers, when he identified Blackstone's blazon. These were not the down-at-heel skinners they had been expecting. Blackstone's bastard horse barged into the nearest mount. Blackstone felt its power surge through his legs, as if the beast had deliberately gathered its strength and lunged with such force that the other horse was knocked off its stride. Its rider struggled to control it, and his raised sword arm was unable to strike. Blackstone eased the reins, letting the antagonistic beast have its head, and rammed his sword point beneath the man's armpit as the bastard horse's momentum carried him past the fatally injured routier. Barely a few strides behind him, Kilbert and the other men thudded into the attackers. The thwack of horseflesh striking horseflesh and the clash of sword blade on metal mingled with cries of exertion and pain. The first assault took Blackstone's men clean through the attackers' ranks, and they wheeled their horses in a tight turn ready to strike again. Unsaddled horses ran wild, their riders dead or dying on the ground. The garrison troops fared badly, unused to such violent close-quarter battle on horseback. Defending a town in a position of strength was different from this sudden onslaught. As Blackstone's men urged their horses back into the fray, those they attacked broke and ran, scattering in a desperate attempt to escape. More were brought down as Blackstone and Kilbert struck at them again, but some slipped past, laying the flat of their sword blades against their mounts' rumps, urging the terrified beasts to gallop faster. Blackstone and Kilbert reined in and let the routiers ride across the grassland. The edge of the forest shimmered as Will Longdon's archers stepped forward and quickly bent into their bows, shooting into the retreating men. The horsemen swerved this way and that, shields raised above their heads. Some of the yard-long arrows punched through shields into men's shoulders. Others struck exposed legs and horses' flanks. The animals whinnied and screamed and fell headlong, throwing some riders down, crushing others beneath their weight. But still, there were those who evaded the arrow storm and raced for the road back to Felice and safety. As they spurred their mounts at the far edge of the grassland, more riders suddenly appeared. Moulon and the other captains, sweeping around from the edge of the forest to cut off the few survivors, blocked their path and hacked the men down. The routiers were overwhelmed, but one man gambled and spurred his horse away from the track obstructed by these new horsemen. He lashed his horse up the rocky ground. Perhaps he knew the landscape and where the animal tracks ran, because he guided the horse expertly this way and that. But it seemed a desperate gamble, for no escape route was visible. Blackstone raised himself in the saddle and waved Wolf's sword above his head. "Stop him!" he bellowed, and then gestured with his sword towards the retreating figure. Renfred was already in pursuit, and another three quickly followed, but their horses balked at the steep, uneven ground. Renfred's horse stumbled, almost throwing him. Moulin spurred his horse along the road to try and cut off the horseman, but it soon became clear that he had escaped. The big Norman spearman and the others turned back to the grassland as Will Longdon led his men down to the dead and wounded. While Jack Halfpenny's men tugged free their bodkin-tipped arrows from the flesh of man and horse, Quesnel's archers killed the badly wounded routiers and drove spikes into dying horses' skulls, putting them quickly out of their pain. The blood-slicked grassland upset some of Tate's horses, causing them to fight their reins. Some of the mounts tried to bolt, cursed at by their riders, until finally they settled and were brought back to where Blackstone gathered the men. Three of his own men were dead, as were two of the Gascons. William Cade's routiers were experienced and had fought hard. 37 men lay dead across the open ground, 2 more on the road. "Is Cade among the dead?" Blackstone called to those going among the bodies. "He's not here," came Moulin's reply. "We must push on, Thomas," said Gilbert, wiping his blade clean. "That man will ride like the devils chasing him, and warn the town. I pray to God that the lad and Perrine have started their journey back, because if they are still there when he returns, then Cade will know he has been tricked."
"You think I don't know that?"
"Thomas, no plan is ever foolproof," said Gilbert. "The bastard was lucky, and it looked as though he knew the ground." Blackstone gathered his reins and spurred the bastard horse towards the road. It was a race now to try and reach Felice before the escaping horseman raised the alarm. The two-faced god of war had been on Blackstone's side, but could as soon turn away and give his blessing to a man's enemy. The lumbering horse settled into its uneven stride. More horses pounded behind him. The heavy thud of their hooves were as war drums beating out their urgency. Chapter 40 Perrine had been fed and then ignored. A monk wandering through the lower rooms and passageways of the chateau was no cause for alarm. Perrine was already worried they had not been allowed to leave Felice. The message had been delivered, and there was no reason for them to be kept in the town. If Blackstone launched an assault while they were still inside, they would be the first to die. He glanced up at the sky, but the buzzard was not in sight. He searched for a safe place to hide for himself and the boy, and for any means of escape. As he had sat in the kitchen, he'd eaten slowly, so that he could listen to any gossip. The fireplace was tall enough for a grown man to stand upright in. It burned logs 3 feet long, and the meat that turned on the spit told him that the Countess did not believe in eating sparingly. A saw-toothed rack supported an iron kettle that simmered with hot water. His clothing made it impossible for him to secrete a weapon, but he had identified where the knives and meat cleavers were kept. Moving around afterwards without challenge, he observed where the garrison troops were in force and where Cade's men were billeted. He made his way to where he last saw Alain and William Cade disappearing into the chateau's main hall. When he asked where his brother monk was, the men smirked and sent him on his way. Their behaviour was enough to tell him that either the lad was inside with the Countess or William Cade was questioning him, suspicious, perhaps, that he recognised him. If violence was going to be inflicted, then he reasoned that it would be this very day, should Alain be unmasked. Failing that, Blackstone would be at the walls by that night. Serving women had filled a wooden bathtub and then left Alain in a room that was heated by the rising steam and the seasoned logs burning with a deep glow in the stone fireplace. Food had been brought, and the Countess had watched him eat, sitting self-consciously away from her at the small table. She remained silent as she continued her sewing, but her eyes seldom left him. He ate delicately, small mouthfuls at a time, wiping his mouth with the napkin, barely able to stomach the food. Anxiety made his hands tremble. The woman's scent was as delicate as a spring flower, and he found it almost impossible not to watch her as she watched him. When she asked if the food was to his liking, he kept his eyes down and muttered his gratitude. The urgency to leave and return to Blackstone was stifled by his desire to be near this woman. When he had finished eating, she called for the serving woman to show him where to bathe. The deep, hot water lulled him. The exhaustion from the journey and the burden of fear soaked away. He suddenly snapped awake. How long had he slept? The water was only warm. The door opened and one of the serving women came in and asked if he needed more water. He declined and asked for his habit, but she told him that the washerwoman were boiling the dirt out of it. She lifted an embroidered robe. The Countess had sent this. Once the woman had left, the overwhelming desire to escape seized him. He climbed out of the wooden tub and padded naked across the stone floor. The door was locked. He went to the window and stood on a footstool and saw that the sheer drop ended on the rocks far below. Panic began to crush him, and the curse of self-pity gnawed at him once again. For a moment it seemed this weakness would drown him, but, as before, he found his resolve. He must find Perrine. The veteran would know how to escape. He heard women's voices beyond the door, followed by the turning of a handle. What he had taken to be a guard robe, covered with a heavy curtain, proved to conceal a door. This opened, and the Countess stepped into view. Her head was bare, dark hair loosened. The robe she wore was sheer, and the darkness of her nipples pressed against the flimsy material.
"You must rest now, Brother Anna, and let me attend to you," she said,
her tone as natural as if he were a welcome guest. He had not yet raised his eyes from her breasts, but as she extended her hand he walked dreamlike towards her, unaware that he still wore no clothing. She took his hand and led him into her bedchamber. The room flickered with dim light from beeswax candles and more scent. The sheets on the canopied bed had been turned back, and as he faltered, quivering with the promise being offered, she turned and cupped his face and gently, like a mother with a child, touched his lips with her own. His chest pressed against her silky arousal. And then he was lost to a drunken state that made him nearly weep with desire. The only words he heard as they settled on the bed were her whispers.
"Slowly, slowly."
The alarm was raised later as church bells pealed. Perrine heard the clamour first and thought for a moment that it was a call to prayer, and that the last thing he wanted was to be dragged into reciting psalms, prayers, or blessings as a monk. He hoped his dullard character would excuse him. And then the cries overtook the bells, rising above their clanging. By the time they stopped, he had made his way to where he had determined would be the safest place to hide. No matter how dark and narrow some of the streets were, if a hue and cry were raised, then every man, woman, and child would seek him out. A door led from the kitchens into the solar, the two great fireplaces back to back, divided by the chimney's shared wall. The solar was unoccupied. The Countess's rooms were elsewhere, and he suspected that was where Alain would be. As the cooks and servants ran outside, he went quickly through the kitchen, lifted a carving knife and a cleaver, and then closed the adjoining door between the two rooms behind him. The solar's grate was cold, but there was warmth coming through from the kitchen fire on the other side of the wall. He stepped into the fireplace, and then raised his hands, until they touched what seemed to be a ledge, which was the inner beam of the fireplace's hefty mantle. It was wide enough for him to lie on. He would stay concealed for as long as it took for the fighting to start, and then he would lower himself and kill as many as he could before he was overwhelmed. The young Frenchman, Alain, was abandoned to his own fate. William Cade's voice echoed in the chill passageway, and at once Countess Catherine's guards banged on her chamber's door and told her that only a single survivor had returned from the sortie. The seductress called for her servants to dress her, and looked at the boy who had given her pleasure. Alain de la Grave, as defenceless as a newborn child, was standing before her still without any clothes.
"Stay here until I call for you. You'll be safe. No one will dare pass my guards. Understand?"
He nodded.
"I will have the laundress return your clothing."
There was nothing he could do other than to get back into the bed and cover his nudity with the sheets that still bore her scent and the musk smell of sex. The raised voices cleared away any headiness from the indulgence of the previous hours. What was important now was not to panic and to brazen out his story. After the Countess left the room, he opened and closed trunks, searching for any men's clothing. Rather than wait for William Cade to convince the Countess that he, Alain, had misled them and caused the death of Cade's men, he would try and find Perrine, and if he couldn't do that, then at least he would get out of this room that was his prison. His search for clothing proved fruitless. One of the bodyguards opened the door and threw his habit at him.
"Get dressed,"
he commanded, and waited. The door still opened behind him. The second bodyguard was nowhere to be seen. Alas, supposed the man had accompanied the Countess. Whatever else he felt, fear and anxiety aside, he knew he was not the same person he had been hours before. He pulled the habit over his head and tightened its rope around his waist. The sandal straps rubbed against the nicks and blisters, but he ignored their bite.
"Follow me," said the guard.
"The Countess told me to stay here."
"She wants you outside."
He hesitated. If Cade had convinced this man to seize him, then he might soon be dead. His hesitation caused the guard to step forward and fling him from the room.
"Outside, you crow bastard!"
As he was pushed down the passageway, he heard the clamour of raised voices and the sound of running feet. He stepped outside and saw people running for their houses, while others were being ushered from outside through the town's gates. He saw William Cade on the walls organising men, and the Countess walking the parapet ahead of him, her cloak gathered around her, the second guard who had once stood at her door shadowing her. There was no sign of Perrine. Had he been killed or captured or gone into hiding?
"Up there,"
said the guard, and put a hand in his back to urge him towards the stone steps that rose to the parapet. As he reached the top of the walls, Cade turned and saw him approaching. He took a couple of strides, grabbed a handful of his loose habit, and slapped him hard. Alain went down on his knees, his ears ringing. He tasted blood.
"Enough!"
the Countess called. But the look on her face told Alain that she no longer cared if more pain was inflicted on him. Cade dragged him to his feet and hauled him to the Countess.
"Did you lie on purpose?" she asked, "about the routiers at the monastery? Only one man returned. He said they were ambushed by hundreds of men." "I don't understand," he said,
realizing that Blackstone had inflicted a defeat on their men and that someone had survived. Bad news had brought the possibility of retribution against him.
"Thomas Blackstone swore revenge," said Cade. "How the fuck did he discover where I was? How has he brought hundreds here?"
Alain's confusion was genuine. How could there be an army at Blackstone's back? Then it dawned on him that the survivor had exaggerated, perhaps to stave off any punishment from being defeated by a small force.
"I did not lie. I saw less than 20 men. I did not know the man's name. Prior Albert gave me the message, and I delivered it faithfully, my lady," he said, bowing his head,
knowing that what had gone on between him and the Countess had been nothing more than fleeting hours of intense sexual gratification with the most beautiful woman he had ever seen, and who had captured his heart at first sight. How foolish that all felt now as she gazed at him with a look of regret.
"Perhaps," she said.
She looked at Cade. "He's yours."
"No," he cried out. "I beg you, Countess, please."
Cade snatched at him.
"I told you what would happen, and now I'll keep my promise. And before you die, you'll tell me where I've seen you before."
Alain twisted free, squirmed for freedom, but Cade's fist clubbed him unconscious to the ground. Cade looked at the Countess.
"We man the walls and bring every villager inside. No one sleeps. Light braziers and torches. I'll order the men to bring hot pitch and rocks. If he tries to scale the walls, the crossbowmen will kill enough of them."
He grinned with anticipated success.
"Your husband chose well. Felice cannot be taken. Thomas Blackstone will die in his attempt, and when I take his head to the Dauphin, I will have reward enough to buy you and this chateau."
He kicked Alain's limp body down to the yard 20 feet below. It landed heavily. A leg twisted and broke. Cade called down to his men below.
"Take him to the cellar."
The Countess looked out across the empty countryside that might soon be filled with an army ready to try and seize her home and inheritance. She turned to Cade.
"You had better make sure this Thomas Blackstone does not breach the walls, William. It is you he comes to kill."
Chapter 41 Blackstone and his men approached the broken ground that lay several hundred yards away from the high walls. They had made good time, and had sight of the chateau just as the sky eased into darkness. Using the rising ground to conceal themselves, they peered across as the red glow from the burning torches and braziers illuminated the ramparts.
Well,
they're expecting us, said Kilbert. Not that they have too much to worry about. I doubt I've ever seen a more impregnable stronghold. You could spend a month building ladders and still not reach the top. Besides, we'd all be dead by the time we got halfway. Blackstone studied the defences. There was no apparent sign of vulnerability, and to try and attack across the causeway bridge and burn down the iron-studded gates would probably kill every man who tried. "Every place has its weakness, Gilbert," he insisted. "We don't know how many men serve the garrison, or what numbers William Cade has," said Will Longdon. "I would need my archers on those walls to shoot down into them, and then we would all have to fight our way up to that chateau."
"The wind is at our back," said Moulin, pointing a finger towards the wisps of smoke from the town's chimneys. "They'll have stables close to the outer courtyard, near their guards' quarters. We could use those braziers and torches to burn them out. Then the smoke would smother the houses and streets. We've done that before. And horses running loose will add to the chaos. If we fight through in small groups, then we would have a chance to get up there, because a killer like Cade will be in the safest place there is, in the chateau. All we have to do is get inside."
As he spoke, Moulin winced at his own suggestion. The assault still seemed impossible.
"Alain and Perrine are most likely dead by now," said Renfred. "If they aren't, then they're either imprisoned or in hiding. If we find a way in, then they might be able to get us into the chateau."
The men fell silent. No one had a good enough idea of how to breach the high walls.
"William Cade could die of old age in there," said Jack Halfpenny. "I'll wager most of the people of Felice are already under their blankets and sleeping soundly, knowing we cannot reach them."
Blackstone raised himself a little more and gazed into the darkness.
"Perhaps not. Look at the chateau. I can see candle and firelight flickering in most of those rooms. But down here, nothing. The village is deserted. They've taken everyone inside."
"We could use those houses for cover," said Renfred.
"That only gets us so close," said Gilbert.
Blackstone pointed towards the houses that pressed against the walls.
"Every window in those houses is dark.
We have rope and hooks to scale that timber walkway from the gully below. We create a diversion, and once we are onto that wooden walkway and into one of those deserted houses, we cut through the roof, and then we're only feet away from the battlements." The men murmured their approval. By taking everyone inside the walls, the defenders had gifted them a means of gaining entry.
"Moulin, have Tate take a dozen men on the left flank of that gully in the opposite direction from the houses. Tell him to keep out of crossbow range. Single file, every man carrying a burning torch. They need to be seen. Make it look as though they are searching for a way inside. Once we are over the walls, they double back and follow us."
"And the woman, this countess? What do we do about her?" said Kilbert. "She's not done us any harm. From what we know, she helps protect the villagers in the district from routiers. That she kills them is nothing less than what we've been doing, nothing less than the treaty would have us and the French do."
"But she's with Cade," said John Jacob. "She's using routiers to trap routiers."
"Or she's beholden to them in some way," said Kilbert. "Perhaps she is even his hostage. We don't know. Going after Cade and rescuing Perrine and the lad is one thing. Killing a countess and her men is another. Even King Edward would think twice about this, and he's a harsh man when it comes to retribution against a defiant town."
The role of the countess had not been considered by any of them, but now that Kilbert had raised the issue, it became part of the problem of assaulting the town of Felice.
"Women, they always complicate a man's life," said Will Longdon. "For all we know, she's dead already," said Moulin. "Cade's men rode against us, but there were few of hers who fought. We don't know how many men are in there, Sir Thomas, and who is to say that there are not patrols beyond the walls? If there are, they could strike at our rear. The woman is less important than our horses."
Moulin made good sense, and Blackstone knew that everyone was aware of the risk they took. He turned away from the manned battlements, pressing his back against the boulders. He looked to where the men waited. The horses had been moved further back into dead ground, hobbled and corralled by fallen branches. He would have to leave men behind to guard them. But to fight through the streets of a town and then try and find a way into a guarded chateau would demand every man he had. The danger was that if they were isolated in the narrow confines, or if they finally secured the chateau, enough of the enemy might escape and stumble across their horses. To lose their mounts would be a disaster. We saw no sign of any patrols, and they are expecting an assault. I'll wager they have every man armed and waiting, inside, not out. Once Tate's men have shown themselves, have them come back here and act as a rear guard for the horses and supplies.
"We could do with them inside the walls," said Gilbert.
"I know. But we have taken towns with fewer men. We strike silently, kill those who resist. The objective is the chateau," said Blackstone, "and we cause no harm to the Countess or her household."
He turned back to study the houses that buttressed the walls.
"Will, Gilbert and I will go onto the walls through the middle house. You will take your archers left and right. Jack and Quinnell will break through the roof on that furthest house. See it?"
Will Longdon looked to where Blackstone pointed.
"We need to kill the crossbowmen first.
And then if we can drive the others from the walls, then it's up to you to deal with them, Thomas. All we can do then is hold the battlements. We'll be hard-pressed if they counterattack from the town."
Blackstone glanced at the veteran archer. Longdon shrugged.
"It can be done," he said, and grinned. "Hold the walls. Keep the archers there. Don't come into the streets. I will send men to you once we have taken the chateau."
Blackstone looked at his captains.
"Ready the men."
Blackstone watched Ralph Tate lead a dozen of his men, blazing torches held aloft, as they skirted the gully that encircled the walls. There were shouts of alarm from those who manned the ramparts, and Blackstone and his men, waiting below the wooden walkway, saw torchlight moving hurriedly along the top of the walls in Tate's direction. They heard the clatter of crossbow bolts striking rocks, but they fell at least 50 paces short of where Tate led his men. As Blackstone's men ran quickly through the deserted village towards the houses against the wall, the captain sent some of them inside the hovels to scavenge for tallow candles or oil lamps. To clamber inside those houses, pressed against the walls, meant that they would have to risk lighting their way into the rafters. Blackstone's men huddled below the wooden walkway as grappling hooks quickly found perches. The men climbed up hand over hand, and then crouched in the darkness, checking that no sentries had heard the bite of steel into wood or seen men's shadows flit into the houses. No door was locked, and no sound came from any abandoned dogs. The citizens of Felice had bundled up their chattels and fled into the town. The dim glow from the spluttering candles was enough to show each group of men the open stairs that led upwards. A half-landing gave another turn to the stairs, and then they saw that half the roof for it had been boarded for storage. Moulin went down on one knee, and Renfred clambered onto his shoulders. Then he reached up onto the edge of the boarding and hauled himself up. He crouched as he pressed his palms upwards onto the slate roof. John Jacob followed and attached a rope beneath one of the rafters, so that the others might clamber up once a hole had been made. Renfred pushed his fist firmly against the nailed slates, which were brittle with age. Two or three broke at the same time, and he whispered quietly to his companion to take the broken pieces from him. The old roof gave way quickly in response to his efforts, and there was soon a hole broad enough for the likes of Blackstone and Moulin to climb through. They, like the others who followed, bore their shields across their backs. Renfred eased his head and shoulders into the night. The battlements were only feet away, and as he looked in the distance, he saw that most of those who guarded the walls were focusing on Tate's men. Will Longdon, Halfpenny, and Quinnell's lightly armed archers had moved even more quickly and made better progress. Darkened figures were already scrambling through the roofs, left and right, and spilling quickly onto the walls. Renfred bent down into the flickering shadows below, and urged the men-at-arms to hurry. The men's heaving effort was punctuated with curses as they tried to stoop below the low rafters. There was room for only 3 men at a time to crouch and then get through the hole. Gilbert was struggling to climb up the rope that led to the rafters. He swore, sweat in his eyes, his age and the weight of his mail and weapons halting his progress. Moulin reached down and grabbed his arms and hauled him unceremoniously onto the half-platform. Blackstone was soon on the walls, Then Moulin heaved himself over the ramparts, followed by a cursing Kilbert. One of the men behind them put his foot through the roof slates, and the brakes sounded as loud as a crack of thunder. Blackstone and Moulin leaned across the battlements and pulled men across in quick succession, now that those below were moving quickly. One of the archers hissed, "For Christ's sake, hurry! They're starting to come back to their posts." Blackstone bent low and ran left along the parapet. In the distance, Felice's men were turning back with their torches. Tate's men had done all they could do, but the crossbowmen among those who guarded the wall could quickly bring down Blackstone's running men as they made their way to the steps that led down to the courtyard. Blackstone had John Jacob at his shoulder, while Moulin had peeled away and taken his men to the right of the breached wall, racing for another set of steps. Will Longdon's men were crouched, backs against the battlements, barely visible in the lee of the walls. And then a cry went up from one of the approaching sentries. Blackstone was already taking the steps two at a time, running towards the fleeting shadows of the garrison men below, who ducked and weaved between the hanging corpses in their attempt to cut him off. If the attack was isolated on the walls before it got into the alleyways, then Blackstone knew his assault would be contained. He felt the air whisper past his face, and then heard the metallic strike of a crossbow bolt against the stonework. One of the men behind John Jacob grunted. There was the sound of a bolt piercing mail, flesh and bone. The man tumbled into space and fell. Will Longdon and his archers stood close together, two abreast on the rampart, as many men as the width of the walkway would accommodate. The first two loosed into the approaching men, saw and heard their arrows strike, and then quickly pressed themselves back as another two shot into the crowded men at the far end of the parapet. In a rapidly moving sequence of shooting and manoeuvring, Will Longdon's archers gained 30 paces more. As Longdon's bowmen drew and loosed, so did Halfpenny's men, buying time for Moulin's men-at-arms going in the opposite direction. Men cried out below. Commands echoed across the courtyard. Blackstone heard the hard breath of shadowy men at his shoulder, saw out of the corner of his eye Kilbert strike out towards four men who ran at him. Renfred was at his back just as John Jacob was at Blackstone's, and then these shadowy men who loomed behind Blackstone fanned out and clashed into the defenders, who hesitated, uncertain whether to throw themselves at the attacking men or retreat into the gloom of the narrow streets and tried to hold back these silent killers. And then a chapel bell clanged out its desperate warning. Its incessant clamour echoed around the houses and walls, calling the town to arms. Chapter 42 Perrine heard men shouting and women's fearful cries as the chateau's servants ran to wherever they thought might be a safer place. And then, as the voices died away, he heard the clanging bell. He quickly eased himself down from the soot-filled chimney and grasped the weapons he had taken from the kitchen. The attack had started, and he needed to do what he could to aid its success. As he ran into the kitchen, he saw two garrison soldiers preparing to throw water over the deep-seated kitchen fire, a fire that could be used against the defenders. They turned suddenly as the wild apparition of a soot-streaked monk attacked them, wielding a meat cleaver and a knife. Startled, they dropped their buckets and fumbled for their swords, yelling in alarm. But Perrine's momentum carried him into them, sweeping the cleaver down across the nearest man's shoulder. It dug deep into bone. The man went down screaming. He writhed, but the cleaver was embedded. Perrine grabbed the second man, who had turned to run, and plunged the knife down into the gap between throat and shoulder. Fatally wounded, the man went down. Perrine turned quickly, and placing his sandaled foot on the other man's chest, yanked free the embedded cleaver. The man's eyes rolled, his mouth opened, but his scream halted as the pointed knife plunged into his throat. Perrine needed as much surprise on his side as he could get, and hoped that the men's death cries had not alerted others. He stopped, listened for any sound of approaching guards, and then quickly went to the stone larder where pig carcasses hung. He dragged three of the dead pigs to the outside of the kitchen. Looking down across the town, he saw spurts of red from burning torches, flames that flickered as their bearers ran in and out of darkened streets. Muted cries of alarm and defence carried through the night. Somewhere in the distance, a donkey brayed, and dogs yelped and howled. He ran back into the solar and gathered an armful of the rush flooring. Back outside,
it took little time to build a small pyre. It would not cause damage, but it would guide the attackers up towards him. Taking a shovelful of coals from the kitchen fire, he quickly got the dry rushes burning. With a final visit to the solar, he yanked aside a tapestry from the walls and dropped it onto the flames. Once the fire took hold, the old threadbare tapestry flared and engulfed the pig carcasses, whose fat fueled the flames. In a final effort to feed the flames, he dragged kitchen stools and a bench to build the pyre higher. He went back into the kitchen and barricaded the door into the solar. If Blackstone's men saw the beacon in time, then they would fight their way quickly up to the chateau, and this door would give them away into the main rooms. And somewhere inside was the Countess and, he hoped, the young Frenchman. There was little sign of any townsmen. Most had barricaded themselves into their homes, and the few militia who had ventured out into the streets retreated quickly when they saw the violence inflicted on the garrison troops and William Cade's routiers. The rumour that an army of mercenaries was at the gates fueled the town's fear. As Blackstone and his captains moved rapidly through the narrow alleys, Will Longdon and the archers secured the walls. The braziers had illuminated the archers' targets, and as Longdon and his men advanced left and right along the parapet, soldiers and crossbowmen retreated down into the town square. The town walls were three-sided, with the chateau forming the fourth quadrant, whose rear walls were so sheer that they could never be assaulted. The fight progressed through the streets upwards towards the flaming beacon. Pockets of resistance formed at street corners, where barricades were quickly thrown down to impede Blackstone's advance. But, shields raised, he and the men at his shoulders battered their way forward into the makeshift barriers. His spearmen thrusting their weapons forward, jabbing into the lightly armed defenders, forcing them to reel back. Grunting and cursing with effort, they strode on, hacking their way clear. Many of Cade's men retreated across the open space of another square towards the town church, whose bell had now fallen silent. Men, women and children, villagers who had sought sanctuary in the town, huddled along an outside wall of the church. There were more than 100 of them cowering, terrified by the darkened figures who swarmed into the square. Children wept, and their mothers screamed at the sight of men being cut down mercilessly. Blackstone saw that the church door had been forced open by retreating soldiers. Kildare ran after them with a half a dozen men, and rammed sword and spear into the narrow gap, slashing at those soldiers who were trying to heave the doors closed from inside. Blackstone broke away and faced the terrified Villeins.
"Stay here," he bellowed at them. "No harm will come to you if you do not run or resist."
The huge, scar-faced man was enough to provoke even more fear in them. They clung to each other as Blackstone turned back to the church. Kildare's efforts had succeeded in forcing the heavy wooden door open, and as Blackstone got there he saw the church was crammed full of townspeople, and that the few soldiers who had forced their way inside had pushed their way in among the refugees, clutching slashed arms and hands from their efforts to resist the doors being shoved open. Blackstone knew there was no sense in trying to reach them. It would only cause slaughter among the huddled mass.
"Close the doors and guard them," he said. "If they surrender, disarm them and let them live."
The heavy doors slammed closed, and Kildare ordered the men with him to stay and do as Blackstone had commanded. Then,
"Up there,"
Kildare gasped, and spat the phlegm of exhaustion.
"Someone's lit our way."
Blackstone looked around the square and saw Moulin advance from one of the side streets, having fought his way through to join up with Blackstone to make the final assault up the curved route to the chateau.
"I couldn't burn out the stables," said Moulin. "The villagers and their livestock were penned at the back, 60 or more peasants with their wives and children. But there's a beacon up there at the chateau."
"We see it," said Blackstone.
"Our backs?" asked Kildare. "Any of these murdering bastards ready to strike at us?"
"I saw none," said Moulin, still breathing heavily from his exertions. "Some of Will's archers are coming down off the walls."
"Send a man back.
Tell them to advance only to where they can use their bows.
Let them secure the squares. I don't want to lose any archers in street fighting.
Any sign of Cade?"
Moulin shook his head.
"He's either barricaded himself in a house or he's up there," he said, tilting his head toward the chateau, shimmering in the light from the burning pyre which illuminated the way towards it.
Blackstone quickly assessed the surrounding houses and the square. The resistance had been lighter than he had expected, and the town had been secured quickly, but there was still no sign of the man he had come to kill, or of the woman who ruled here.
"How many have we lost?"
Four men dead, as far as I know, said Moulin. Some light wounds. We cannot risk the townsmen rising up once we have pushed up to the chateau. Moulin, hold your men here. With Will Longdon's archers on the walls, and those that come into the square, they should be enough to protect our backs. Gilbert and I will take the rest of the men up to the chateau. Moulin immediately turned away and ran to organize his men.
"Do not race to the top and start the killing without me," said Gilbert.
"Don't worry, my friend. Cade and his men will not surrender without a fight." Blackstone's grin broke the darkness that played across his face. "Shall I find one of those brain donkeys to carry you up there?"
"Thomas, I swear you have no respect for your elders."
Gilbert snorted snot from each nostril.
"I'm pleased I taught you well."
With that he turned and strode briskly uphill.
Chapter 43 Perrine stood his ground in the kitchen, as men on the other side shouldered the connecting door. They knew that this was a way in for their attackers. The chateau's main doors were locked and barred, but this kitchen access into the solar was the weak point, and someone had barricaded it from the kitchen side. And even if the defenders barricaded the door where they were, those entering the chateau through the kitchen could burn the door down. Whoever was in the kitchen needed to be stopped, and the outer door closed. The defenders' choice was to open the main doors and flank whoever was in the kitchen from the outside, or to push through whatever was blocking this door. Going outside seemed a greater danger than trying to force their way through. Perrine had dragged the heavy kitchen table used for preparing food across the door, but the more the men on the other side pushed, the more it gave. It would not be long before they breached his defense. He wrapped a kitchen cloth around his hands and lifted a pot of hot water from its stand above the flames. The table shifted. Men swore and heaved, and then three soldiers appeared, shoulders against the door. They pushed hard enough to force the heavy table aside. Big men, blood-flushed faces, beards flecked with spittle from their efforts. One was already clambering over the table to reach Perrine, who hurled the hot water at him. As the man's hands went up to his scalded face, Perrine threw the pot at the others and picked up his cleaver and knife. He did not wait for them to clamber forward, but lunged at them, throwing himself across the table and stabbing one of them in the face. The other brought down his sword, and Perrine felt the blade cut through his habit. It seared his flesh. The pain spurred him. He rolled, felt the squelch of blood on his back, and prayed his left arm would work as he raised the knife in an attempt to block the second strike. The blow was hard and forced his blade away, but his effort deflected the slash that would have taken his arm. He swung his free arm and struck down with the cleaver. It cut through the skullcap helmet and embedded itself into the man's head. He fell without a sound, the force of his falling body yanking the cleaver from Perrine's blood-soaked hands. He winced in pain from the slash on his back but ignored it, dropped to the tabletop and began pushing it back against the door. The sudden sound of men at the kitchen door made him swirl, knife in hand. Blackstone and John Jacob, with two men crouched ready to attack. They saw the bloodied monk.
Perrine!
Perrine grinned and leaned back. Blackstone strode quickly to him as others stormed into the kitchen.
"You look like a monk from hell," he said, looking at the soot and blood that covered the fighter.
The cut on his back was deep enough to need attention. Perrine slumped. The fight had gone from him. Blackstone half-supported him to a stool.
"All right, my friend, I have you," he said. "That wound needs attention."
Perrine gave a dismissive gesture.
"Through there," he said, pointing to the door. "The solar, and then the other rooms. I think there are more men in the chateau. I held here as long as I could, but you came just in time."
John Jacob had already ordered men to guard the other side of the door they had breached.
"You lit the fire?"
Blackstone said. Perrine nodded as Kilbert came into the kitchen. Sweat streaked his face, and he was breathless. "A good defensive chateau should always be built on high ground," he wheezed, "but not when I have to attack it." He moved across to where Blackstone stood with Perrine. He unceremoniously tugged Perrine's shoulder down so he could poke a finger into the wound. The stocky fighter winced. "Get Will Longdon here to stitch it, or, better, sear it with one of those irons in the fire," he said, "but do it quick." Perrine looked at the veteran knight, realizing that the urgency in his voice meant the wound was worse than he thought.
"I get it done," said Gilbert,
in answer to the unspoken question.
Perrine nodded. "Find some wine." Blackstone ordered a couple of men waiting at the door,
Others were already crowding in, ready to join the fight. "Brandy, if you can." Men quickly rummaged on the shelves. "Where's the lad? Where's Alain?" said Blackstone.
"I don't know. He was taken inside to the Countess when we got here. That's the last I saw of him."
One of the men stepped out of the larder, a clay flask in hand. "Brandy," said Thomas. Blackstone gave it to Perrine, who drank thirstily, then coughed and drank more.
"Merciful Mother of God, this is going to hurt like hell."
"Hurts once, and then it's done," said Kilbert, and took the flask from him, swigged heartily, and handed it back.
"You go on," said Perrine to Blackstone and Kilbert. "I've no wish for you to hear me cry out. Cade and his men are inside somewhere."
"Bellow like a carving cow," said Kilbert. "I brought the walls down about my ears before now, when I've had a wound cauterized." He rested a reassuring hand on Perrine's shoulder. Blackstone sheathed Wolf's sword and laid aside his shield. He eased Perrine to his feet as Kilbert picked up the piece of cloth that had been used to lift the pot of water. He twisted it and put it between Perrine's teeth. Then Blackstone laid him face down on the table and ripped the habit open further to expose the cut. He nodded to Kilbert and two others to hold Perrine's arms and legs as John Jacob pulled out a hot, riddling poker from the coals. They wasted no more time. Blackstone seized a cloth, wiped away the blood, tipped brandy into the wound. Perrine's back muscles bunched as the liquid stung, and then John Jacob laid the red-tipped poker across the wound. Flesh sizzled. Perrine bellowed, and then passed out. "Leave him on the table," said Blackstone, arming himself again and pushing through the knot of men who had gathered in the solar. They peered into the gloomy interior. There was no sign of Cade's men or any garrison soldiers. They stood silently, listening for any sound that might alert them.
"Man's stupid, if he only holds upstairs," said Kilbert quietly. "We could set fire to the place and let them roast in hell." "He didn't hold the town. He had no militia. And how many of his men did you see?"
"Not many." "No," agreed Kilbert. "A few levies and a handful of Cade's men. They were on the walls. It was mostly garrison men in the streets. We killed enough of Cade's men when they tried to ambush us. If he has more men, then he would have pitted them against us. We've killed most of them."
"So where is he? How many men can he muster?"
Blackstone looked at the men who accompanied him.
"Then, if he doesn't have enough men to fight, he has something to bargain," he said.
"Alain, he holds the lad." "Or this Countess is being held prisoner," said John Jacob.
Blackstone nodded. "All right, John, you take four men and search these rooms down here. Sir Gilbert and I will take the others to the upper rooms." The men raised their shields and followed Blackstone and Kilbert up the stone stairway that turned onto a half-landing ahead. No cresset lamps flickered, plunging the stairs into deep shadow that verged on darkness. Blackstone stopped halfway and turned to the men behind him.
"When we turn up there, our backs are exposed to anyone on the landing above, and if they have crossbows, then we die here. Be ready. Sir Gilbert and I will draw them out."
Blackstone and Kilbert trod carefully forward, and then, as they reached the half-landing that exposed them to those above and behind them, they quickly turned, raising their shields. They had no sooner exposed themselves than the sound of crossbow bolts being loosed cracked the silence. Blackstone and Kilbert, backs pressed against the stairwell, crouched as two quarrels struck close by. No sooner had the men on the stairs heard the taut bowstrings loose than they charged past Blackstone and up onto the landing above. Experience had taught them that if crossbowmen laid an ambush, then they would release their bolts all at once in their determination to kill their enemy. As they raced up the stairs, they were quickly proved wrong. There must have been four archers on the landing, because another two quarrels struck the first two men, who fell back dead into those who followed. The attack faltered, but Blackstone and Kilbert were already pushing their way through the stumbling men.
"Forward! Keep going!"
Blackstone yelled. He and Kilbert were quickly in the near darkness and saw shapes of men moving against them. Dim light caught sword blades and a sudden cry of "Attack!" bellowed from whoever held the landing. Blackstone braced his shield, pushed his arm forward, felt the impact of an attacker's sword and thrust Wolf's sword instinctively, feeling its sharpened point bury itself into the nearest body.
No sooner had he and Kilbert pressed forward than the men behind them were quickly at their side, and their shield wall forced the defenders onto the back foot as they closed. Once the cries of defiance were spent, the thud of shield against shield and blade against flesh and mail became a muted, grunting effort to kill. Light spilled onto the landing as two of the grappling men fell against a door which gave way, exposing a fire in a grate and candlelight. Kilbert and Blackstone saw there were no more than 8 men defending the landing. 3 others were already dead at their feet. He and Kilbert punished them with a sustained attack. Soon there were only 5 men standing. They cried out for mercy. Blackstone raised his sword to halt the attack. Kilbert commanded the cornered men to lower their shields and drop their weapons. They were Cade's men, and had fought more stridently than garrison troops.
"We'll die here if we must, with sword in hand, but we'll not be butchered defenceless," one of them declared.
"Throw down your weapons and you'll live," said Blackstone, as he stepped across men's corpses and levelled Wolf's sword at them. The routiers looked uncertainly at each other, but when their leader threw down his sword and shield, the others followed.
"William Cade, where is he?" said Blackstone.
One of the routiers pointed up the continuing flight of stairs.
"He's with Countess Catherine. Her rooms are up there.
Sir Thomas, I beg you, let us live."
"How many men are with him?" snarled Kilbert, pressing his face closer to the defeated men.
The man who spoke for the others shook his head.
"Sir Gilbert, I don't know. There are few of us left now, but the Countess has men loyal to her."
Kilbert looked at Blackstone. He was ready to kill the men who had surrendered. Blackstone shook his head.
"There were 2 monks sent here, one younger than the other. Where is he?" "I don't know, and that's the truth," answered the mercenary. "When the alarm was raised, we manned the walls and then fought through the streets. This was to be our last place of defence."
John Jacob and his men pounded up the stairs.
"Nothing below, Sir Thomas."
Blackstone gestured to one of his men who had fought on the landing. "You and 5 others seize these men and take them to Moulin. Have them bound and held. If any one man tries to escape, kill them all." Blackstone and Kilbert turned for the upper story. John Jacob was astride behind them.
"Still no sign of the French lad."
"We'll find him. He's here somewhere," said Blackstone as they reached the top floor.
2 double doors faced them. The men let their breath settle.
"John, break down the doors."
John Jacob stepped forward with one of his men. They braced their shields and rammed the door. They flew open. Blackstone faltered at the doorway. Across the room, seated by the comfort of the fire, was a woman of rare beauty. She was dressed in fine silk clothes and wore precious gems that caught the light. She had the bearing of a queen, ready to receive homage rather than a woman who might be facing imminent death. An armed guard stood either side of her. Big men who looked ready to die at her feet. Each held a sword in one hand and a snarling dog on a chain in the other. An older man stood respectfully just behind the seated woman.
"I am bailiff to this noble household, and Countess Catherine Duval. Who is it that invades her home and kills our men?"
"I am Thomas Blackstone, and you harbour a murderer and a thief. For all I know, you aid and abet his killing."
The bailiff took a half pace forward, but before he could speak, the woman stood. There was a slight tremble in her voice.
"I am Countess de Valle. Do not judge me until you know me better," she said.
The Countess made a slight gesture to the part of the room which was obscured by the doors. Blackstone stepped forward.
"Is this the man you seek?" she said.
William Cade was on his knees, arms bound behind him, and gagged like a captured thief, guarded by another 2 garrison soldiers. Chapter 44 Blackstone ignored the bailiff and the 2 men holding William Cade, and with 6 quick strides put his boot into the kneeling man's chest and sent him sprawling. His guards were too startled to react quickly enough, and they took faltering steps backwards away from the scar-faced Englishman. Blackstone turned and looked at the Countess.
"Stand your men down, or have them and your dogs slain."
"And you will do what with me?"
said the Countess defiantly. "I will question you and expect answers, and then I will decide your fate."
"The Countess has the protection of the King of France," the bailiff said.
"I've never liked him," said Blackstone. "I won't ask you again. Send your men out and tell them to surrender their weapons to my men, and keep those dogs chained and under control."
One of the bodyguards stepped closer.
"We are the Count Henri de Val's sworn men, and since his death, we serve my Lady Catherine. We do not leave her alone with you."
Blackstone gauged the two hefty men. They could be killed and overwhelmed, but their fearless loyalty was something that could be respected.
"Very well. Stay with her until she commands you to leave."
He looked towards the two men who stood with William Cade.
"Have these men surrender their weapons and take the dogs. What needs to be said should be done without their snarls interrupting us."
The bodyguard looked at the Countess, who nodded her assent. Without hesitation, the two men handed over the chained dogs, and the two garrison men lay down their swords. Blackstone's men stood aside from the doorway as the muscular beasts were taken from the room. There was a moment of calm once their threat had been removed. Blackstone laid aside his shield and slipped Wolf's sword into its scabbard. There would be no assault from the two men who guarded the Countess, unless she so ordered. But it was obvious to the men and to the Countess that they would die before they even reached Blackstone, with or without sword in hand.
"You align yourself with this scum," he said, meaning William Cade.
"Am I to be questioned like a common prisoner, sir? I do not discuss my private affairs in front of unwashed, blood-stained soldiers."
Her courage and defiance in face of the brutal-looking men who gathered in the doorway impressed him.
"John, have these men taken downstairs. Secure the main doors to the chateau, and send word to Moulin to give safe passage to those who sought sanctuary in the church and the square. Have the people return to their homes, and take their livestock and chattels with them."
He faced the Countess. "Does that give you some assurance, my lady?"
"I am grateful," she said.
There was warmth in her voice, enough to easily entice him to stay in the room with her.
"Do you have a physician who serves this household?"
"An apothecary, in the street below the church," she answered.
"Fetch him for Perrine," Blackstone told John Jacob, who stood ready to pass on Blackstone's orders, "and leave three men outside the door."
He nodded his dismissal. As the men clattered down the stairs, Kilbert closed the door behind them and pulled off his sweat-soaked helm. He walked across to a table that bore a flagon of wine and a tray full of glasses. He hesitated momentarily and looked at the Countess.
"With your permission." "You assault my town and kill my men, and you ask if you may help yourself to my wine?"
"Killing your men is thirsty work, but there's no need for bad manners," said Kilbert, pouring the wine. Blackstone pulled off his gauntlets and took the glass of wine Kilbert offered and slaked his thirst. He laid his helmet on the table.
"We were sent into a trap by Prior Albert, but we learned of his treachery and ambushed the men you sent to kill us. The prior is in your pay."
"I seize routiers who terrorize my people. I capture and kill them in revenge for my husband, son, and daughter, who were murdered by them 2 years ago. I make no apology for using men like William Cade to entrap them. I take pleasure in my revenge. I inflict pain on them at every opportunity. I knew nothing of you or the men who ride with you. Prior Albert considered you mercenaries."
"We are men on the English king's business," said Blackstone. "A treaty has been signed and agreed by your king and mine. I enforce that treaty."
"And Chateau de Felice is not ceded to English rule. You have no right to do what you have done," insisted the bailiff.
"I came on Felice by chance in my search for Cade," said Blackstone.
"Be careful whom you kill and why you kill them. He also has protection. He serves the French crown," the Countess said.
Kilbert snorted at the news.
"Thomas, this bastard was planted on us."
Cade's muffled curses meant nothing. Kilbert pulled off his gag.
"Listen to her. She's speaking the truth. You harm me, and word will get back to Paris," said Cade.
"We don't intend to harm you," said Kilbert. "We're going to kill you. Traitors deserve a slow death. An Englishman serving our blood enemy should be made to suffer.
and you must pay for killing a young archer who was promised safe conduct. Cade squirmed.